It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The city of Milwaukee is trying to promote housing growth at a time when we're seeing a mismatch between the housing stock available and the needs of Wisconsin communities. Last week, we heard from UW-Madison urban planning professor Kurt Paulson about that mismatch around the state and the need for additional housing. He said zoning requirements need to change in many communities. Today, we're learning more about a potential solution in the works for Milwaukee that could offer a path forward for other cities around the state. The city is undergoing an initiative called Growing MKE that aims to change Milwaukee's comprehensive plan to update zoning codes in ways that make it easier for developers to create more housing in the city's neighborhoods. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble finding a place to live where you want to live that you can afford? Do you want to see your community update its zoning codes? Do you want to see a wider variety of housing types in neighborhoods, mixing, say, single-family homes with duplexes or other housing units? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Sam Likling is the City Planning Manager for the City of Milwaukee's Department of City Development. Sam, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Rob, and thanks for having me.
Start us off by telling us a little, please, about this Growing MKE initiative.
Well, thanks. I think you hit on it earlier. There's a lot of discussions going on both statewide and here at the city on how do we meet the housing needs of a changing population. And I think we're excited to be tackling that issue head on at the City of Milwaukee. Obviously, our mayor, Mayor Cavalier Johnson, has been explicit about his goals for wanting to see the city grow and also wanting to make sure that we're meeting the housing needs of our residents. And so Growing MKE is an initiative to have a really thoughtful and broad-based discussion about how will Milwaukee choose to grow. We want to use this process to talk about how we'll encourage housing growth and choice through our zoning codes and our land use policies, and use the feedback we get from the public to really set that growth for housing growth and choice in the city of Milwaukee moving forward.
Now, I think for most people, if they're going to read zoning codes, it's at bedtime, maybe as a sleep aid, but it's important stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about how zoning works and how important it is in determining what happens in a community?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think at a high level, it's important to know that what zoning is, it's the set of rules and regulations that affect what gets built. And that's why everyone should care about it. And the history of zoning you asked about was, you know, most cities, Milwaukee in the 1920s passed its first zoning code. And that set rules for what can happen on each individual parcel and also what building designs would look like, how tall a building could be, how close to the street it has to be. And one of the initial reasons zoning was adopted was to separate uses and protect the public health. For example, you didn't want a rendering plant next to a single family house. And so zoning was initially used to address nuisance issues, but it's also over time evolved to be something that's very explicit about what can be built and where. And obviously, as you're hearing kind of the national discussion on zoning, we as a planning profession have also had to grapple with the fact that in some cases, people have used the tool of zoning to exclude and to limit the types of housing that can be built in certain neighborhoods. And that's had impacts on things like affordability and walkability. And thankfully, in Milwaukee, we have a pretty progressive tradition of planning. And I think we have a really great set of frameworks that have allowed for our city to evolve organically over time. And we have these great walkable neighborhoods. And we want to make sure that our current regulations continue to support that and support it citywide.
I mentioned that conversation with UW-Madison planning professor Kurt Paulson about a housing mismatch, not just in Milwaukee, but around the state. Here's a bit of that interview relevant to our conversation.
The market for years, given our zoning regulations and the financing, really preferred that large kind of new build suburban style house. So three or four bedrooms, right? 2,500 to 3,000 square feet. We build a lot of those, the large single family homes. And then we build a lot of more urban apartments, one or two bedrooms. So a lot of planners, designers, policymakers are looking at what we call the missing middle. That's that in-between product. We used to build a lot of in cities, right? This could be everything from boarding houses to what we call granny flats or accessory dwelling units. It's the duplex, the townhouse, the condos we were talking about. We just don't build a lot of that and have not for 40 years.
Sam, I want to pick up at that concept of the missing middle. I think I ran across that exact phrase in some of the materials about your project there in Milwaukee. Can you talk about how the plan you're trying to develop tackles that missing middle that might open housing up for a lot of people?
Yeah, thank you. I agree with what a lot of Professor Paulson said. Like a lot of cities across the country, we haven't seen a ton of that middle style of housing developed. But one of the things that sets Milwaukee apart in a good way is we're blessed with those styles of housing in many of our neighborhoods. Anyone who's familiar with the city, you know, if you picture your favorite city neighborhood, my guess is it's a neighborhood that has a variety of styles, small apartment buildings, duplexes, live-work units, mixed-use commercial development. So we're really blessed with the good bones, as people say. And in many of our city neighborhoods, we continue to allow that. There are some parts of the city where we don't currently permit that kind of middle style of housing. And we want to have a discussion around, you know, how and where should we continue to permit that. Now that's
talking to Sam Leichling, City Planning Manager for the City of Milwaukee's Department of City Development, looking at a plan in the works, early stages to try to allow for more kinds of housing development in Milwaukee, meet more needs, ultimately bring more people into housing in the community. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Whether you are in Milwaukee yourself or not, are you seeing similar challenges where you live? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So, Sam, what kind of changes, and again, this is early stages, what kind of changes are you looking for that would allow more of that mix of housing to go to new and different neighborhoods, even where it's not currently part of the mix right now in Milwaukee?
Yeah, thanks. Some of the types of recommendations that we're pursuing is allowing those styles of housing, whether it's duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, in more parts of the city beyond where they're already permitted. We also want to look at something called accessory dwelling units, and that's a style of housing that everyone has a different name for. Some people might call it an in-law suite, a cottage house, a granny flat. Just acknowledging that, you know, as you talk about some of the demographic changes that we're seeing both statewide and locally, there's a significant need for housing choices that will allow people to age in place, that allow for intergenerational living. And we want to make sure that both our policy planning and our regulations both permit and encourage that. And, you know, we talked earlier about Professor Paulson's comments on those things just aren't being built. There's a few reasons for that. One is regulatory, and I think we certainly want to make sure our regulations support that. And another is economic. We know that the construction costs, financing costs, that's hard for anyone to navigate right now. And so we want to, at the same time, we're making sure our regulations permit and encourage that. We want to work creatively with other partners in the housing sector to say, how do we make sure that those options can also be attainable and accessible so they do continue to get built, just like they were, you know, as Milwaukee was growing as a city.
Another part of the proposal would also remove minimum parking requirements for some new housing development in Milwaukee. Why that change? What are the hopes for that?
Well, Milwaukee right now has some of the lowest requirements for parking in new developments of any city in the country. Again, that's a trend you're seeing across the country. Other cities move to either reduce or eliminate parking requirements. And that's a step that we took 20 or so years ago to advance our goals for walkable urban development and housing choice. Earlier this year, the City of Milwaukee's Common Council adopted a climate equity plan. And one of the recommendations of that climate equity plan was to continue to look at how we handle parking and transportation across the city to reduce the amount of vehicle miles traveled per person and to work on achieving some of our climate goals, which rely on, you know, a denser form of development and hopefully reduce individual reliance on automobiles. And so as part of that climate equity plan, our policymakers have said we want to continue to explore if there's changes to our parking policies that will advance those goals. As planners, I think our ultimate goal is to just make sure that we're not putting artificial rules in place that encourage excess parking at developments. And thankfully, from our discussions with both existing developers and review of data, I don't think we're doing that here, but it's an option it's a topic we need to continue to explore to make sure that we're not driving up the cost of housing or negatively impacting our environmental sustainability and equity and climate goals by creating excess parking. And that's a part of the discussion we look forward to continuing to have throughout the Growing MKE project.
We're talking to the City of Milwaukee's Planning Manager, Sam Leichling, about the Growing MKE initiative, which would update Milwaukee's zoning codes in an effort to promote more housing development, more different kinds of housing for people with different needs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Access to housing. A lot of communities are trying to tackle this problem right now. What are you seeing in your community? If you've been looking for a place to live, are you finding the kind of stuff that you need or having to go further away from where you work or settled for something smaller or maybe something bigger than you actually wanted. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up the conversation with Sam Likling, City Planning Manager for the Milwaukee Department of City Development. He's with us today to look at proposed changes to Milwaukee's zoning with a new initiative called Growing MKE, an effort to make more housing, more variety of housing available to more people. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 for this Growing MKE plan. What do you think about what you've heard? Do you like this idea? Are you curious? Do you have questions, whether you live in Milwaukee or beyond? And wherever you live, are you dealing with that mismatch between the kinds of houses that are available, if any, or rentals that are available, and what people actually want and need? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Sam, I want to talk a little bit about process. People might think, okay, the planners, the city council, they come up with a plan, they put it into place. No, it's a longer process than that. Can you talk about what goes into taking the starting point and making it a reality?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. And I think I want to start by just talking about the why we're doing that and how we get there. And I think the whole Growing MKE initiative is designed around translating that civic and community and leadership vision for the city we want to continue to grow into and the type of city we want to be. And then how do you translate that vision into regulations? And so the process that we are taking to do that is first, we're having those high level discussions with the public. We're talking to members of the public. We're talking to technical experts, developers, architects, and trying to have that discussion around vision. How do you see the future of housing growth and choice in Milwaukee? What are those choices that are missing? How do you see the continuing housing development meeting our goals for the walkable urban neighborhoods we all want? And we've spent the last few months having those discussions. And now we're at a point where we're ready to use all of our, all that input we've gotten as, as professional planners. It's now our job to say, if that's the vision, how do we have a land use policy and a zoning framework that support that? And we're ready to start sharing some of those recommendations with the public. We have a series of open houses scheduled in the next few weeks. On Monday, November 27th, we'll be at the Mitchell Street Library from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And then on Monday, December 4th, we'll be at the Good Hope Library, also from 5:30 to 7 p.m. And that's where we want to have some of those discussions of, here's what we've heard, here's the kind of feedback we've heard from people, here's what their vision, and then here are the recommendations for how we think we can translate that vision into reality through planning and policy. We're also going to provide opportunities for people to take surveys, and all that's on our website. I should make sure to plug the website, sure. Of course, city.milwaukee.gov/growingMKE. People can sign up to get more information on the process, get notices when there's more materials and surveys. And then we're going to spend the next couple months taking that feedback. And then at some point in late spring of next year, presenting an amendment to the citywide policy plan to the Common Council that they hopefully will adopt. And then we'll take that action and move forward and begin to actually update the city's zoning code.
Let's bring on a caller. Lanny is with us in Ashland. Lanny, hi.
Hello, how are you today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I just want to tell you, I do have some experience in, finding a place finally. I live up here in northern Wisconsin, originally from Cincinnati, Ohio, and bounced around for a little while up here in northern Wisconsin, living in a motel over in Washburn and paying $650 a month just for one room, see? But then I wanted to move to Ashland. I finally found a place. But I guess what I want to tell the listeners is it's going to take a little time and, work with the community agencies that in order that you might be get on the list finally. And then once you get on the list, there's other places that will help you with rent and stuff. But I guess anything I can really say is, I found a beautiful place in Ashland, and, they give you help. I'm retired. I'm 72 years old. So, the shelter's all filled, so wintertime's coming. So housing is very critical, in the state
Randy,
of Wisconsin.
Randy, I got you. We don't have a lot of time left, but thank you, and I'm glad you found housing. Sam, is there a room in this plan that for people who are in a precarious housing situation, homeless or on the verge, or as Lanny said, kind of bouncing around?
Yeah, that's, of course, we hear stories like Lanny's all the time, and it's great to hear that there's partners working on that up in Ashland, and we're really lucky to have partners working here in Milwaukee on how to meet the affordable housing needs of people across a wide variety of spectrums, wherever people find themselves in life, both from an age standpoint, income standpoint. The city of Milwaukee worked with a variety of partners in 2021 to create Milwaukee's Collective Affordable Housing Strategic Plan that was led by the Community Development Alliance. And it laid out a series of strategies to make sure that as a city, we're providing an affordable home for every Milwaukeean. And that's not something that you achieve just through zoning. There you have a variety of partners working to create new affordable rental homes, help existing homeowners preserve their homes, and help people achieve the goal of home ownership. And we have an amazing group of partners working on that here in Milwaukee. And we're just very lucky that we're have such a wide variety of partners working on those strategies, because it is complex. There's no one single answer to those complex housing issues. And it's an initiative that we're happy to be part of in supporting the Community Development Alliance implement the Collective Affordable Housing Strategic Plan.
Just our last few moments, Sam, assuming this plan goes into place more or less as it is, when do you think we'd start to see more housing, maybe a decline in housing costs for people?
Well, the good news about a city is that it's always changing. And we are working with developers every day who want to bring new developments to the city of Milwaukee. And a lot of that can occur under our current zoning code and current land use regulations. And so you'll continue to see housing developed in Milwaukee. We think that if the zoning code's updates we're proposing, you'll just continue to see more of that. You'll continue to see housing development occur across the city at a wider mix of styles and in a pattern that will continue to allow Milwaukee to be just this really thriving, walkable urban city that we all come to love. And so I'm really excited to get to work on this and excited to hear feedback from people over the next few months as they hear the recommendations and can provide input to us on how they align with their own goals for how Milwaukee should choose to grow.
Sam, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's Sam Likling, City Planning Manager from the Milwaukee Department of City Development. He was with us today to share details on proposed changes to Milwaukee's zoning codes and the city's growing MKE plan. He mentioned the link online where people in the community can comment on it. We'll post that at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you've got a story about efforts to improve access to housing in your community, wherever that might be, let us know about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. A political battle over diversity programs at the universities of Wisconsin is the latest sticking point between Republicans and the university system. In the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision striking down affirmative action in college admissions, Rich Kramer reports that there are real questions about what campus diversity policies will look like in the future.
At UW-Parkside's freshman orientation, around 50 students and parents are spread out in a campus auditorium. The lights dim for a video message from the former chancellor.
Diversity is a signature feature at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Students from over 20 countries are part of our learning community. I'm Chancellor Debbie Ford, and you are welcome here.
It's a familiar message, but off campus, videos like this are newly controversial. Republican lawmakers have targeted the universities of Wisconsin over their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. UW-Parkside freshman Anaya Young of Milwaukee wants to be a child psychologist one day. She says she chose the school because it feels like an inclusive campus. She was unaware of the political battle over DEI.
I just don't understand why they would be upset about it. I don't.
Young disagrees with GOP claims that diversity programs divide students by race and offer advantages to some groups and not others.
I don't think that is racial preference. I think that is racial appreciation.
One powerful critic of DEI programming is Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. At the state GOP convention in June, he told the crowd the letters should stand for
division, exclusion, and indoctrination.
He claimed the concept has become the new religion for the left.
So the overt racism, the overt exclusion, the overt indoctrination is so deep inside the UW system, I am embarrassed to be an alumni.
Voss followed up this speech with action against the universities and their employees. At a time when Wisconsin had a multi-billion dollar budget surplus, Republicans cut the UW's budget by $32 million. Voss is now blocking pay raises for around 34,000 workers until DEI positions and programs are eliminated. Attorney Dan Lennington of the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty says a June U.S. Supreme Court ruling banning the consideration of race in college admissions means many college diversity programs are now illegal.
And all I would say is that if you couldn't do it to an African American, you can't do it to a white person. So whatever the DEI training happens to be, you can basically tell whether it's illegal or unconstitutional by just flipping the script.
Catherine Meyer studies education policy at the Brookings Institution. She says the Supreme Court's ruling was narrow, but she expects conservatives to ask the High Court to change that. Meyer sees two broad trends at play in the current battle over DEI. Republican voters, she says, have a less positive view of higher education, for one.
The other is just this broader trend that there is a history of racial backlash in America.
Meyer and other DEI supporters say it's about making more students feel welcome on college campuses. While the number of students from what the UW calls underrepresented minority groups has grown by 19% in the past decade, white students still outnumber them by around 6-1. At the same time, graduation rates for Black, Hispanic, and American Indian students at state universities are between 14% and 25% lower than they are for white students. President of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce, Tim Sheehy, said in July that for the business community, DEI isn't a fad. He says companies are embracing efforts to make themselves more welcoming to workers from minority groups.
If you look at the workplaces we have today, if you look at workplaces in Wisconsin, just put simply, we are not going to fill those jobs with the white population. It's not growing fast enough.
At the Wisconsin Capitol, the DEI battle continues. Bosses standing firm on blocking pay raises until colleges axe diversity initiatives, and Democratic Governor Tony Evers is suing Voss and other lawmakers, claiming the holdup is unconstitutional. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A note that WPR staff are employees of UW-Madison. You can find that story and all the latest coverage from our news department over at WPR.org. I'm Rob Barrett. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's gun deer season begins on Saturday, and the state's Department of Natural Resources anticipates the hunters out there are going to be older and fewer. This is nothing new. Baby boomers represent the largest cohort of hunters in Wisconsin. The number of them returning to get a gun deer license has been steadily declining for years now. That can have a big impact on how the state manages the deer population and how it funds conservation programs. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you getting ready to go out this weekend for the beginning of the season? Have you been a hunter for years? Is this your first year, or do you think it might be your last? If you stopped hunting a few years ago, love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Smith is outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He recently wrote about this topic. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob. Great to be with you.
I gave the basics there. Can you tell us about this ongoing trend we're seeing of fewer and fewer people each year going out for that deer hunt?
As you mentioned, Rob, it's not a new trend in Wisconsin. We had a peak of license sales for a gun deer license in Wisconsin in 1999. And since then, that number of licenses sold has declined. And probably the single biggest reason is this generation of baby boomers who hunted unlike any generation before or after, is starting to age and leaving hunting for a variety of reasons. You know, some of them, it's just a matter of getting older, losing interest, or some move out of state. Some get in health conditions that don't allow them to hunt or lose access to spots to hunt. There's a variety of reasons, but the bottom line is people aren't coming into the sport like they were in the past. So the loss of these baby boomers is not being replaced, and we're seeing a net decline in licensed hunters.
I want to talk about what that means in a couple different ways. First of all, part of the state's deer management plan involves a certain number of hunters being out there harvesting deer. Is this decline in the number of hunters affecting that, interfering with that?
It certainly has the potential to, Rob. The gun deer season is the single largest contributor to the hunting account for the DNR. So, you know, it's still substantial. There's a decline here, but it's important to note that there's still a very large number of licenses sold and participants. This year it's expected to be around 550,000. And when it peaked, it was about 690,000. So it is down about 140,000, but still substantial. Those licenses sold form the single largest contribution to this hunting-related management in the state. And it's also important because the number of licenses sold is used by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service when they're spreading out money from a excise tax on hunting gear, including guns and ammunition, and that's spread around to states. And part of the formula for that is a number of licensed hunters. So it's certainly a concern for the DNR. And it's one I know they've worked to address. You know, there have been active programs called R3 recruitment, retention, and reactivation to try to make up for these losses. But so far, the loss has been greater than the new hunters coming in.
Talking about Wisconsin's upcoming deer hunt and a declining number of deer hunters with Paul Smith from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul gave me a great segue there, that R3 program. Emily Eel is with us, hunting and shooting sports R3 coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here, Rob.
Now, you've been listening to our conversation so far with Paul. Can you talk about now this R3 effort, the effort to bring more, maybe different demographics of people into deer hunting?
Yeah. So as Paul mentioned, there's been some really big demographic changes happening in the hunter population. And then there's also been some really big cultural shifts. Such as urbanization. There's more people living in cities than ever before. And then just how people value nature and wildlife has changed over the last few decades. So it's pretty unlikely that we're going to reverse the trends that are and the drivers of the decline in hunter numbers. So the goal of our program, the R3 program, is to provide opportunities for people who want to learn. So typically in the past, people would learn to hunt through their family or neighbors, people close to them. But that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And so our goal is to provide programming and connect people with others who can teach them if they don't have those folks in their network.
You have a few different programs that I think at different levels for people. Can you tell us the different pathways the DNR offers for people who didn't maybe learn to hunt, as you said, from their parents, but want to give it a try?
Yep. We try to provide a large menu of options just because there's no silver bullet for teaching people how to hunt. There's no cookbook and everybody is at a different stage. So we've done programs anywhere from taking people on 4-hour squirrel hunts on, you know, on weekday afternoons to programs where we meet multiple times over the course of a month and we spend a really intensive weekend actually hunting with novices. We pair people up one-on-one. And then this year, we've been focusing a little bit more on specific skills. So we've had a lot of fun and success scheduling deer butchering workshops in the different regions throughout the state. So I think we've done 7 of those, and they've been really popular. We've had people coming from hours away, and it's really fun to see the variety of people who come to those programs, because it can be anywhere from people who have hunted their entire lives and are just looking to pick up some tips and tricks on how other people do things. And then we've had classes that are the majority people who have never processed their own deer and who might be complete novice hunters, whether they've gone at all or maybe they're in their first 5 to 10 years of doing that. So it's been really cool to see.
Now, deer hunting season is literally just around the corner, but if people want to get involved in these programs for future hunts, so what do they need to do? Where do they need to go to get set up with this?
So we have an email subscription list, and if you go to the DNR events page, we post all of our events there, so that's always a good place to check out. Otherwise, we partner with a lot of organizations around the state, so We try to post everything on our website, but you can always reach out to me, or we have regional staff. We're excited to bring on 4 new partner positions too, through Pheasants Forever, the National Deer Association, Raised at Full Draw, which is an archery focused organization, and Pass It On Outdoor Mentors. So reach out to any of us and check out the DNR webpage, and you can find what we're offering.
Emily, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Emily Eel, Hunting and Shooting Sports R3 Coordinator for the DNR. We talked about some DNR efforts to offer alternative pathways for people, including younger people, to get into hunting. Paul Smith stays with us, Outdoors Editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, you've been following deer hunting in Wisconsin for a long time. What kind of things do you hear anecdotally, you know, about why the next generation, maybe if you're talking to that baby boomer, why the next generation didn't follow in their footsteps or bootsteps?
Right. Well, I grew up in Racine County here in Wisconsin, and so it was a different time. I'm actually, if you opened up the dictionary and looked for the baby boomer deer hunter, you could see my picture, because I'm 62 years old and I'm just right at the peak of this wave that's now passing. And so when I grew up, it was very natural to hunt, and I didn't really have to ask or look very far when I knew I was interested in it. And since then, I've served as a mentor in some of the programs that Emily just mentioned. And so I've got to meet people who have more challenges today to hunt. And then I've also served as a mentor to friends and children of friends, and et cetera. It's a different world, Rob. You know, it's just a whole different world how people relate to outdoor activities. And hunting is actually, you know, it's another step. It's one thing to go out for a hike and to maybe go bird watching, but to go hunting requires, you know, some extra gear and, it's a different intention. You want to bring an animal into possession, kill it, and bring it home for food, mostly. And while there is some motivation there, I see a strong motivation for wild, locally sourced food. Mm. It's still a smaller percentage of the population that wants to do that than, you know, when I was in my teens. So that's the big lift that the DNR and other agencies have, is trying to appeal to younger people today and people of all ages. I've mentored people who are adults too, who are just, you know, adult onset hunters. It's a big challenge. We have to also mention that it's not just in Wisconsin. This is a nationwide event going on where hunting is declining, or hunting license sales are declining. So, and I think I have a high regard for the programs that are being offered in Wisconsin, but it's just a different era here in 2023, Rob.
Talking to Paul Smith, outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at the upcoming deer season. The gun deer season starts this weekend. fewer hunters, older hunters out there now, according to the DNR. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your story, your question. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Paul Smith, outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, talking about the changing demographics of deer hunters in Wisconsin. The largest cohort, baby boomers, then the gradually declining number of gun deer licenses. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Timothy is with us in La Crosse. Timothy, hi.
Hello there. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm 78 years old, belong to a mentoring group called CAMEL, Kids and Mentors Outdoors. And there's like five chapters in the state of Wisconsin. Our charge is to try to get kids outdoors, not just hunting, but anything outdoors, from hunting, fishing, canoeing, kayaking, birding, whatever you have. And it's just a difficult problem, to get the kids. And what's even more difficult is to get adults, mentors. We're all aging out. And it's hard to find people to join something like CAMEL, Kids and Mentors Outdoors.
And Timothy, before I let you go, Timothy, I wanted to ask, it's just a few days away from the deer hunt, if people want to get involved with that as a mentor or mentee, is it too late or can they still sign up?
Well, for kids, it's too late to really do anything that way. We do have, at Poinette, we have what we call a Joe hunt. And the kids can, and this is an excellent thing, in the sense that they, at Poinette, they have, the state of Wisconsin actually has almost like a dormitory. They have a kitchen where they feed the kids and they get a chance to hunt. I think it's somewhere around December 7th. They might look into that and try to get kids and mentors together there. But
excellent, Timothy. Thanks a lot for the call. Paul, not just the DNR, but other groups around the state working to bring new people on board with hunting and other outdoor activity we just heard.
Absolutely. Dozens of them are in that work, Rob. And I went up and I stayed at the McKenzie Center 1 year with CAMEL, the group that Tim is with, and slept in the dorms and went on deer hunts with them. I'm very familiar with their programs. So there's a lot of people working on the same problem, and people in the conservation community are fully aware of how important it is to help young people and people of all ages to make that connection to the outdoors, whether it's hunting or other things. There's so many positives that can come from it.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Timothy. We'll go to Brad now in Tomahawk. Brad, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I was just calling in because I heard your radio thing about the diminishing people getting tagged and stuff. And I'm from Tomahawk, and we had a hunting party of probably about five where we haven't seen a deer in probably 5-6 years. In fact, we've seen more wolves, coyotes, and bears then. So there's been a loss of interest.
Brad, I gotcha. Not a great signal, but I get your point. Brad saying they're not seeing deer out there. Paul, looking at statewide deer population numbers, the trends are up, I think, over the last few years, but that doesn't mean in any one particular hunting site there's going to be deer there.
Exactly, yeah. The operative phrase is deer densities vary, even in a local area, and they're not I think they say distributed evenly across the landscape. And in Tomahawk and other parts to the north, the deer herd there can have effects of severe winters, which either kill deer or reduce survival. And we have more predators in the north also. So one could make an argument that the deer herd is better balanced in the north, a more natural balance. But if you're a deer hunter and you haven't seen a deer up there, that argument doesn't carry much weight. I feel for hunters who want to go out and see deer. That's usually the number one criteria for a successful hunt is actually for deer hunters to actually see a deer, not necessarily kill one. And if you're out there for hours and don't see them, then creates a less satisfying experience, and that can cause people to stop hunting for sure. I've heard from many people who've said they just aren't seeing the deer anymore. And because it takes some effort, you know, especially if you don't live in that area, but you traditionally travel to northern Wisconsin, you might just decide to stay home and spend the weekend closer to home or change your hunting area. Certainly deer populations can affect the number of hunters in an area.
Thanks for the call, Brad. We are talking about Wisconsin's deer hunting season, declining number of people hunting over the course of time in Wisconsin. Paul Smith with us at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And back to your calls now. John is with us in Algoma. John, hi.
Hi. I had two thoughts. One's related to the camo idea. I'm not a hunter. I'm a fisherman and belong to Trout Unlimited. And we run a summer trout camp. I know our chapter donates to a summer camp for kids. Doing some things like that and having hunting groups sponsor summer camps or fall camps, maybe a long weekend camp might be a possibility. The other thought is kind of heretical, I think. It's probably heresy, but I'll say it anyway, and that is I used to have a friend, a lifelong friend, who was an avid hunter. And as I said, I'm a fisherman. I live close to Lake Michigan. He lived up in Oneida County. And while I was going to retire and live up there, he was going to teach me to hunt. But unfortunately, he died. When he was still alive, he would share the his hunt with me, and I would share frozen salmon and smoked salmon with him. And we did it for years, and it was, there's nothing any very formal about it. We just did it. The thought crossed my mind that perhaps there would be a way for people like myself, and I'm in my later 70s, to buy a second ticket for somebody, pay processing costs, and maybe work out something else as an incentive, because wild game is wonderful and I certainly like it, and I've lost my source, and I rather suspect as people are aging out of hunting, they are likewise, and perhaps there's something that could be worked out.
Interesting, John. Thanks a lot for the call. Paul, I don't know if anybody's thought of or proposed things like this where somebody like John, who doesn't hunt or can't hunt anymore, sponsors that current hunter, buys that second ticket, pays for the processing, so the hunters out there are hunting for two instead of just one.
Fantastic idea. I've never heard it proposed before. I've heard it. Similar things in different areas of the outdoors. For instance, the federal duck stamp, people would buy two instead of just the one that they need to hunt, but it would just be a way to contribute more to the wetlands fund that the duck stamp supports. But I've never heard anything similar to what John just recommended. I think it's a great suggestion.
Interesting idea, John. Now, Paul, I want to take our last little bit of time. Give a little forecast or what are the conditions looking like for the deer hunts? Not a lot of snow on the ground in most of the state, which I understand is a big factor.
Yeah, it's a big factor because when you have snow on the ground, the deer are much easier to see as a hunter if you're looking across the landscape. If it's going to be brown like it is this weekend and the brown deer are moving, it just makes it much more difficult for hunters. On the positive side, the forecast calls for mild temperatures, so hunters could spend more time afield, and that might help increase their odds of filling a tag. Last year was perfect, just about perfect on opening weekend, and the deer kill was up 14% year over year last year, largely because of the great conditions opening weekend. I will be heading to Madeline Island in the Apostle Islands. It's the farthest north I've ever deer hunted, but I think the conditions are going to be without snow. So I'll see what we can turn up on Madeline Island.
Paul, thanks again for joining us today.
So much. Thank you, Rob.
That's Paul Smith, outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him today about the aging, declining deer hunter population in Wisconsin ahead of the start of the state's gun deer season this Saturday. Still time for you to share your experiences, what's led you to start hunting, stop hunting, or stay in it. If you're a younger person into hunting, love to hear from you. Email ideas@WPR.org. Tomorrow in the morning show with Kate Archer Kent, a preview of the 2024 election campaign in Wisconsin with the heads of the state's Republican and Democratic parties tomorrow at 8 on the Ideas Network. The price of postage has gone up slowly but steadily over the years. This year, sending a letter costs 66 cents, more than it used to, but still pretty cheap. But be careful which stamp you put on there. If you pick the wrong one, you could overpay that postage by $2 million. As reported in the New York Times, a legendary postage stamp that's become a collector's item just broke the record for the most expensive stamp ever. It auctioned for $2,006,000. The stamp is called the Inverted Jenny. It's a stamp from 1918 featuring an airplane. On one printing, one sheet, the plane was printed upside down. Just 100 of those inverted Jenny stamps were printed, so they've become a highly prized treasure. This particular stamp was in great condition, set undisturbed in a safety deposit box for years and years. I'm never going to pay a lot for a stamp, but I like the idea that our mistakes could be turned into money. If that's true, I should be rich. Stamp news you can use. This is Central Time.